was fierce. It rekindled Minka's flagging defiance. "I don't care," he said. "Whenever they come, we'll be ready." Rath had no answers. "In the last supply drop, they sent us these." From his pack, he pulled a rattling cloth bag. He lifted up a handful of small glass vials. Sask looked grim. "Frenzen." Rath took one from his palm and held it up. Tarvi gave him a hard look. "You think we're done for?" "No. But if there's nothing left, I won't take it," Tarvi said. "I'm a Cadian. I'm no penal legionnaire that has to be drugged into battle." Rath looked about. He was looking for takers.
"Maybe we'll take more of them out," Sask started.
He was finding it hard to get his thoughts out.
"I mean, if we kill more of them, does it matter how we go?"
Minka remembered the hanging bodies. Maybe it would be better to go into the long night mad. "Give me one," she said. Rath put the file in her palm. "How do I take it?"
"Bite it," he said.
"And what happens when it runs out?" Rath gave her a hard look.
"Don't worry. When it runs out, you'll be dead."
That evening, Rath's company sheltered in a crated building, half of them awake, staring into the darkness, looking for whatever might come. Minka faced south across the ruins. They stood up like broken teeth. She thought she saw shadows, but nothing came. Nothing moved, and she heard nothing, except the heavy breathing of Olivette, who was watching the street with her. "Did you take any?" she said. Olivette shook his pocket. It rattled with files. Minka had her file, but she couldn't imagine going mad into the darkness. It was too much like the unnamed. "Think you'll take it?" He shrugged. "Not until the end." She nodded and felt for the file through the thick cloth of her jacket. It was small, hard, faceted. "I don't think I'll take it." "So why did you take one?" "Just in case. I want to go sane and disciplined." "Like a shock trooper," Olivette said. "Yes. It's all I ever wanted to be." There was a long pause. "Think we're still White Shields?" She looked up. "Well, you still have the stripe on your helmet." He laughed. In normal times, they'd have been promoted from White Shield to shock trooper after they'd killed their first enemy. But these times were anything but normal. "I won't take mine," Minka said. "I don't want to end my life like a mad dog." After the first watch was over, Minka woke Tarvi. He jumped awake, and she had to whisper to him to calm him down.
"Just me," she said.
He nodded and blinked and pushed himself up. Minka took a turn resting, but she found it hard to sleep with the baleful purple and green light of the Eye of Terror throbbing in the night above her. It was so bright that it cast a shadow on the ground. Even when she closed her eyes, she could see it. She tossed and turned, pulled an old greatcloak over her head, and dreamt that she was flying above Kazimierz, and that beneath her, the city was as bright as a summer day, before the war. She was safe, she understood, and that was a feeling she could almost not remember. She was light, she was radiant, and she was safe. 2 hours before dawn, Minka was wrenched awake to cold and dark, and the shouts of frightened men. She did not need to be told it was the Volscani.
"Where?"
she hissed. Tarvi was crouched next to her. His face was smeared with dirt and ash and sweat, and half lit by distant gouts of promethium. He gave her a quick brief. A two-pronged attack through the second floor of the hab blocks overlooking Munitorum Street. There were shouts, the bright flash of las rifles, and then the crump of grenades going off, and suddenly a flamer firing into the night. Rath was already moving, slapping his chief fighters awake.
"Quick," he hissed. "Come."
Tarvi was up. Minka followed. They used the sewers and basements to come up at the Volscani from below, firing through the broken floorboards, while other teams came at them from above, pinning the Volscani down like an animal caught in the upper and lower fangs of its hunter. The fight took nearly 2 hours of desperate hand-to-hand combat. Rath dispatched the last Volcani with his knife, and the survivors picked their separate ways back to the riverbank ruins. Minka was beyond exhaustion. Her feet dragged, Her body ached. She was parched. Her mouth was full of dust and ash.
All right?
Rath asked. Minka shook herself and nodded. She had drifted off.
Yeah. Sure?
She nodded, then realized that her shoulder was bleeding. She pulled her jacket back. It was difficult to see clearly. Rath took her arm. His face was expressionless.
Looks clean, he said. Make sure it gets bound up.
Minka nodded. She couldn't find any words.
Tavi!
Rath called.
Get her patched up.
Minka slumped down. She closed her eyes. She fell asleep for a second and jerked awake when the needle pricked her skin.
We should be dead, she said.
Tavi nodded.
Are they teasing us?
Tavi didn't know. There's less of them. See the lights? He pointed vaguely northwards with his chin. The flicker of battle was drawing slowly closer. She thought she could hear its distant rumble. It was all she'd yearned for, all she'd dreamt of for months. But now it was here. It seemed as distant and unreal as a desert mirage. Tavi sounded cheerful.
I think the relief is coming. I think the enemy are taking a pounding out there.
Minka paused. Sir Kazimirak will be relieved after all. Does Rath know, do you think?
He knows. But even if they're coming, how many of us are left? I don't think we can hold out.
For a moment, despair filled Minka. She teetered on the edge of it and knew it was the exhaustion, knew it was what her enemies wanted, to break her spirit, to crush her soul. She felt the presence of the archenemy, like a clawed fist, crushing at her heart. And then, a memory of being lifted into the sky and being told the sacred duty of every Cadian, to fight, to resist, to never give in. She swallowed back the dust in her mouth, said a prayer to the Golden Throne, and there, like a wavering light in the distant darkness, she felt hope. It ran through her bones like a slug of Amasek. She took the phial of Frenzen from her pocket and let it drop to the ground. She stamped down, cracked it open with the heel of a boot. It smelled like licorice and spice. It was good to let it go. To take Frenzen was to be like one of them, the enemy. She was human. She was Cadian. She was a fighter. There was faith in her bones. I think we can hold out, she said. Exhilaration ran through her like stims. She gripped his hand.
You must believe, Tavi.
She held him by the shoulders.
Believe, she told him. We can't do it. Do you believe?
He stared at her, and she could see that he did not. His eyes glistened with tears as he pursed his lips and shook his head. He did not feel it. He was dead tired, exhausted, fearful. But there was a fierce belief within her. She shook him and he swallowed and nodded. At last, he croaked the words out.
Stop, Minka. Please. You believe for me. That'll be enough.
That evening, Minka woke with a start from a dream where she had been buried under rubble and was drowning in the dust and gasping for breath, until a golden light shone and she floated up from the rubble like a feather caught in a gust of air. The elation woke her suddenly, and she saw her fellow standing about her. She was sleeping on a shelf of rubble. Her greatcoat was thrown over her shoulders, her legs hooked to her chest. Her limbs were sore as she straightened them out. She wanted to see what they were all looking at. As she stood, she saw to the north the flashes and fires of fighting closer to the city.
They're coming for us, Rath said.
In the distance, there was a sudden bolt of red light. It shone out, and then there was a rumble of an explosion. It seemed much closer than before. Tavi stood up. How far is that? Rath shook his head.
20 miles.
Might as well be 100, Tavi said. The lights dimmed, and the fighting seemed to have died down. It was as if a long, dark room had been momentarily illuminated, and when the shadows returned, they seemed deeper than ever. No one said anything for a long moment. They were too tired, too battle-weary. Their hope had flickered for a moment. Only Minka stood staring north. Her sleep had been brief and fitful, but her exhausted body no longer needed anything but belief. Her faith became stronger as their strength grew less. It filled her now, almost like a light. It made her pale face radiant in the darkness. "There will come for us," she said. She looked down. They were all staring up at her like a prayer day congregation, and she felt a devotion to the golden throne surge through her. "There will come," she said. "It will not be long. Victory will be ours. All we have to do is hold out. We must never give in. Understand? Never." Their pale moon faces stared up at her, wanting to share her confidence. Her gaze went from face to face, and a smile spread. At last, she looked across at the seated men and women and saw the dull red light of Wrath's augmented eye. The captain said nothing. He did not believe in hope. Chapter 7. Elysian Fields. There was nothing the space wolf Scarp Hedin hated more than these twisted, malformed parodies of the Adeptus Astartes. They were not just abhorrent, they were dangerous. Their ability to grow weapons from their infected flesh repulsed him. Killing them was not a pleasure, it was a primal need, it was a duty. As war swept across the pylon forest of the Elysian Fields, Scarp Hedin was feeding that need. The Chaos Space Marine had two malformed mouths. They both snarled as it tried to form another arm. Scarp Hedin's sword crackled blue flame as it cut the budding limb off. The mouths moaned with pain as Scarp Hedin's boot crashed down onto the creature's chest. There was a crunch of power armor, bone and flesh. "Brother," a voice spoke in Scarp Hedin's ear, but the space wolf was too intent on killing to pay it any heed. He lopped off the monstrous traitor's limbs as children would pick off the legs of beetles. And now he was going in for the kill. As he reached down, one mouth mewled in incoherent agony and suffering, but the other spoke to him.
"You can kill me, but victory is within our grasp. You will not see it," Scarp Hedin snarled. "You are as lost as I."
Scarp Hedin was beyond words. He put his weight behind the sword's hilt and drove it through the neck of the thing beneath him. It died with a shudder, and Scarp Hedin breathed the stink of blood deep and looked about for another enemy to kill.
"Brother,"
the voice spoke again. Scarp Hedin spun on his heel and stared about him, looking for foes. The Eye of Terror filled the sky with purple, and on the plain around him were heaps of bodies. Moments came back to him. While human armies met in vast battles, two elite warbands of space marines and their chaotic brothers had met each other in an exultant duel of sword and axe. Scarp Hedin had followed his master, Ottar the White, as a hound follows the pack leader. The melee had attracted more and more ancient warriors, like carrion to a dying beast. Now, as Scarp Hedin spun about, it seemed that no one else lived. Nothing moved. His nostrils flared. He could tell the blood of his gene brothers apart from that of their foes. He could smell their gene seed despite the distortions that chaos had wrought. He sniffed for warm blood. He smelled for life among the piles of dead. He stood at the top of a hill of bodies in the grey and black power armour of the Space Wolves and the Black Legion. Heads had been severed. Gore puddled about the fallen bodies, each showing the excessive trauma that it took to kill a member of the Adeptus Astartes.
"Brother!"
Scarp Hedin spun about, crouching low, ready to fight. They had been surrounded. There had been hundreds of Black Legionnaires. But now, they had all gone. He had not killed them all, he was sure. His mind scrolled back through the vid relays in his helmet. No, he had not killed them. They had fled before his fury, climbing back into dreadclaws and landing craft and blasting off from the planet. Scarp Hedin laughed, great fangs bared in his supreme confidence. He had been outnumbered. He had fought them, and he had destroyed them. He beat his chest with berserk fury and exultation.
Traitors and cowards!
Something moved at Scarpedon's feet. He put a board round into the thing's skull. It had once been a member of the Emperor's children. Now it was dead, its last lungful of air coming out in a tide of red bubbles. He looked down and saw that he was standing on a pile of the dead, 50 bodies deep. His grey armour was flecked with blood, some of it his. He snarled as he spun about, looking for another opponent. But the land was empty except for the dead. And all knew that the dead did not rise again.
Brother!
From the top of the corpse mound, Scarpedon looked out on the hell of battle. In the far distance, ruined tanks still burned, like foothills to the vast wrecks of titans and leviathans that rose over them all, their empty hulks now dark and flame-stained and silent. Closer to him, where his warband had been brought to ground, hills of the dead rose up, crags of heads and torsos and boots, covered with the grotesque covering of reaching hands and fingers, like the wretched flora of a demon world. The hills marked where each of his fellow brothers had stood and fought as they tried to cut their way through the enemy, and had been brought low. The air stank of death and blood, and from deep down in the bottom layer of bodies, the unholy reek of decay. And there, at his feet, beneath the headless stump of the obliterator, he saw the shriveled skull of his chieftain, Ottar the White. It all came back to him as he stared down at the body before him. His chieftain, surrounded by foes, setting about him with his axe and calling on his retainers for help. Scarpedon had ripped through human and transhuman. The air was thick with the stink of superheated blood. His sword still sizzled as if it wanted more.
Lord, he hissed. Brother, Lord, I have failed you, Lord. Brother!
The ancient Space Wolf chieftain had taken wounds to his arms, legs and torso, but it was the final melter shot that had seared a hole through his grey and gold-worked power armour that had done for the ancient warrior. It had taken out one of his hearts and had overwhelmed a body already wounded, already weakened, already dying.
I failed you, he said through fanged teeth that snarled in fury. We have failed this world. Brother, the planet is lost.
The words had no meaning for him. Above him, the eye of terror filled the sky with lurid patterns of purple. They cast a baleful light. Scarpedon had to force Ottar's dead fingers open to get the blade free. Even in death, the Space Wolf would not let go.
The planet is lost, brother.
Scarpedon's fingers lifted the great double-headed axe. The weapon balanced in his hand, light only for a Space Wolf. Scarpedon's fangs drew back as far off an artillery duel reached a crescendo. Lightbringer was as old as Fenris itself, a beautifully crafted weapon, haft and blade all forged from a single block of meteoric iron. It felt warm in his hand, the blade still crackling with nascent energy. The blade glimmered darkly, and Scarpedon grinned. He knew that the deal had been struck.
Brother, the planet is doomed!
Scarpedon's nostrils flared as he sucked in the Cadian air. Far off strobes of lance fire stabbed down through dark, rolling clouds of smoke and ash. In the flickering darkness, he saw the wild light of packs of demons blinking through the immaterium. More enemies to kill. With great, loping strides and limbs that did not tire, the Space Wolf began to move south. He was the last now, the last of his warband, the only one to carry the names of the dead and their great tales back to Fenris. This alone was responsibility enough. He could not let the feats of his brothers go unrecorded.
Brother, the planet is doomed. We need to get you off the planet. Confirm position.
The voice was insistent inside his helmet, but Scarpedon was lost to the joy of hunt and battle. A star appeared in the distant sky, and above the thunder of battle, he heard the distant howl of Wolfen, and in answer, Scarpedon put his head back and howled. Zafur the Hermetic was dead, with all his cursed warriors about him. They made a fitting cairn for Ottar the White. No space wolf could wish for more. Chapter 8, Point 395, Myrak Front. Valentin's Hellhound squadron was still half a day away from the Elysian fields when the Marauder destroyer swept low over the ground. Four more followed, and the last one gave them a simple salute as it waggled its wings and swept on southwards, weapon mounts fully loaded with hunter-killer missiles. Valentin couldn't remember the last time he'd seen air support.
"Just look at that," he said. "Where the hell did they come from?"
"I don't care," his driver said, "as long as they put those weapons to use."
As the roar of the marauders diminished, they could hear the vox playing Flower of Cadia.
"Hush,"
Valentin said, and turned the volume up. It was Creed's voice at last.
"People of Cadia, shut up!"
Valentin punched his gunner, and the hellhound slammed to a halt.
"You have done all that I have asked, and more. You have driven the enemy back. You have won the battle for Cadia."
There was a pause.
"You have won. But it is my duty, my heavy duty, to tell you all that Cadia, our home, is doomed. Not for lack of courage and strength on your part. You have won the battle. Your honour is unblemished. You might think that this is a defeat for us, but it is not, I assure you. Preparations are being made now. After this message, there will follow a broadcast announcing the evacuation zones where landers will come to lift you all from the planet. I repeat, this is not defeat. The fight will go on. We shall carry the flame of Cadia back to the Imperium. We shall fight to defend Holy Terra itself."
At the end of the broadcast, a different voice, strained with emotion, recounted a list of evacuation sites. Valentin's crew listened in numb silence. The list started at the beginning again. It repeated three times before anyone spoke.
"Freck,"
Valentin said. He looked up and the others nodded. "Freck." Myrak Front, 17th Army Group. Lena's Hammer of Tyrok was spearheading an assault on a Volscani redoubt. She was stripped down to her undershirt. Her back was slick with sweat, her forearms slick with lubricants and soot, her vox bead hanging about her neck. She fitted the chains around the crack shell, pulled it across the tank, and lowered it carefully into place.
"Loaded!"
she shouted. But instead of firing, there was a pause.
"Loaded!"
she shouted again over the salvo of heavy bolter rounds fired by the front gunner. The bolt feed jammed. The gunner pulled at the bolt rounds, and the loading mechanisms clicked as the bolts fed in. They were so busy fighting that they didn't have time to pause as Flower of Cadia began to play. But when Creed began to speak, Ipsic turned the volume up, and they worked a little harder and faster. But then the evacuation order was issued.
"What did he just say?" Ipsic said.
Lena paused, but then a round pinged off the front of the tank, and she slammed the breech closed.
"Loaded," she said.
Ipsic cursed as the turret swiveled round.
"Loaded?"
"Loaded,"
Lena called back. She caught the driver's eye and lay back against the magazine panels.
"What the frick did they just say?"
The tank rocked back as the main gun fired.
"Confirmed kill,"
he said, and dropped down from the firing seat into the tank.
"Did they just say evacuation?"
His crew stared at him. None of them moved. They'd all heard it now, and now the vox was listing evacuation points. Lena's immediate reaction was that she was not evacuating. She was not evacuating her home. She would fight and die with her home. But the list of extraction points kept repeating. Lena kicked out.
"I don't fracking believe it,"
she said. Chapter 9, Renault Tract, Cadia Secundus. The Drukian Fengard was what the Munitorum classed as light infantry. Tough tribesmen used to privations and working independently with little support or equipment. Movement was something they excelled at, but for the last 2 months they had been fighting a losing battle as the fens cover they had been relying on had been gradually eroded by fire or simply swarmed with enemy troops. Iason Quinn was Widlowis of the Kern clan of Druk VI, who anointed the scribes of the Munitorum as the 53rd Drukian Fengard. He took his role of counsellor, lawgiver and rememberer seriously, especially now when it seemed the existence of the Kern clan was at risk. They were like the Drukian fangfish, whose pools had been drained and who were left flopping back and forth on their sides. The Drukians were deep in the frozen marshes of the Renor Tract, where miles of rattling dry sorghum were draped with trailing mist, fighting an army made up of cultists from a number of hive worlds who still bore their Ganga tattoos. The sorghum was as thick as bamboo. It made the perfect environment for the light Drukian troops, and despite their small numbers, they'd been fighting for months, half hidden within the trackless miles. The Chaos troops had resorted to clearing whole tracts of land with flame. The Fengard warriors were putting up a stubborn resistance as they retreated deeper into the marsh, but the numbers of dead were gathering pace all the time, and mile by mile the enemy were finally hemming the Drukians in. The end could not be far off. As he waded through the stagnant water, Iason knew that there was no more point in running. It was time to call on their father, the Emperor, to make their last stand. A grenade exploded about 50 feet before Iason. There was an outbreak of firing, a short and vicious cross-stitch of las rounds in the tight confines of the marsh. Iason crouched as he saw a squad of Fengard retreating at an oblique angle to the battle. They were wearing their rebreathers. Their eyes met his and they signed to him to keep moving back. It was all they'd been doing for days. Iason slipped back, leaving a brief ripple, the marsh sorghum barely rustling.
Look!
One of the others signed to him, and he looked up. There had been many stars in the months that they had been fighting, bright explosions in high orbit as fleets of vast cruisers pummeled each other with ferocious broadsides. But this one was unlike the others. It seemed distant at first, and not quite like a plasma reactor overloading. It was too small, too yellow. It grew in intensity at a steadily accelerating rate. Iason nodded. A hand touched his shoulder.
Chief wants you, said the Drukian. You must come now.
Iason found the Drukian chief standing with his retainers in a small, dark pool, slick with an oily film of promethium. The chief's elite attendants were dressed in all kinds of shabby imperial cast-offs, all now the same drab and faded grey. Their faces were obscured by their crude rebreathers. Tubes wound around their necks and shoulders. Their skin was blue with tribal tattoos, and all wore their clan knife slung from a plaid sash. The chief's face was pale yellow with the light of the Eye of Terror.
We are nearly surrounded, Widlowis.
Yes, Lord.
I have decided that I will die here on this mound.
Iason nodded. Then I am glad to stand here with you. The chief's face was stern.
You cannot.
But, Iason started. His chief spoke over him.
You know all the old stories of our clan. One of us must escape Cadia and bring news of how the Cairn clan died.
Iason looked around the others. They were all staring at him over their rebreather masks. He understood.
Not me. It is my order.
Iason looked at the faces of the other retainers. Behind their rebreathers, their eyes were hard and set. They had determined it. This was the moment for them to die. He would not be with them. Iason felt betrayed.
I cannot leave you, Lord. You are my clan chief. What is out there but a hostile world? Men will look down on me with contempt and say that I lived when my Lord did not. I could not live with the shame. It is my order, Iason, the chief said. One of us must escape to tell the tale of how we fought and died.
Another firefight broke out, even closer this time. As Iason looked at their faces, he saw their eyes grow bright. They shone with a yellow light. One of the retainers saw it first. He signed and pointed. There was a star in the sky. It was growing brighter. Iason turned. They all followed the gaze. The star lit the sky like a second sun. After a few moments, it was too bright to look at. It cast a shadow on the ground. They could hear its roar, like an earthquake rolling towards them. Iason cried out as it passed overhead, filling the sky. The sonic shock threw him flat. He found himself on his hands and knees, staring at the silhouette of his head against a burning sky. And he remembered the prophecy about the end of the world. That doomsday would come with a bright star, too bright to look upon. As he lay there, he saw flames. The whole marsh was burning. The story of his clan would never be told. The Fens of Druk would never learn how her sons had fought and won and died. The star that lit the skies of Cadia was a fragment of an ancient object of Xenos technology known as a Blackstone Fortress. The archenemy had propelled it towards the planet, and despite all the combined firepower of the remaining shreds of Battlefleet Cadia and the Adeptus Astartes strike cruisers, they could do little more than blow chunks off its edges, like chips from a piece of flint. Desperate captains flew their defense monitors into the Blackstone, hoping to deflect its course, but the ancient hulk had been propelled forward at such a speed that there was no way it could be stopped or hindered. The smaller pieces hit the planet like shooting stars burning up in high orbit. The main fragment was as large as a moon. It hit the stratosphere and its edges started to burn. It plunged down, an incandescent missile tearing across the atmosphere above Cadia Tertius and Secundus and whipping up whirlwinds behind it. The vacuum it created caused a sonic shock that crushed tanks. The impact caused a crater 200 miles wide, and the shockwave sent gales and tremors that leveled everything for 1,000 miles. Millions of tons of earth were thrown up into the atmosphere, creating a mushroom cloud that filled the mesosphere with enough dust and debris to cause a millennia-long ice age. Concepts like day and night no longer had meaning. Huge cracks rippled through Cadia's crust. The tectonic plates of Cadia Prime began to break and blister as shockwaves thundered out like ripples from a brick hitting a pool of still water. Tsunamis of magma broke the mantle of the planet. Rockreed bastions were thrown to the ground. Ancient Khazar were levelled, but worst of all, the forests of Cadian pylons, which had held back the warp for so many millennia, were thrown down in ruin. At this, the Eye of Terror began to reach out for Cadia and seize it. The Cadian gate was not just breached, it had ceased to be. The cesspool of the warp now rushed through the gap, swamping all in its path. The dark gods laughed. As storms wrapped Cadia, the last Black Legion kill squads fled the planet, chasing their flagship, the Vengeful Spirit, as the ancient battlecruiser retreated. They left the heretics and cultists to their fate. The populations of entire hives, entire worlds that had fallen to the despair and treachery of the dark gods. What did they care if the millions of slaves died? The Imperium of Man could supply many more. Without their Black Legion masters to guide them, the cultists fell upon each other in berserk blood rites, ritual slaughter or scenes of debauched cruelty. They made easy targets for the disciplined Cadians, and surviving units mounted fighting withdrawals as they made their way to the nearest evacuation stations and left the planet. The few remaining astral choirs tried to pierce the warp to alert Holy Terror. Their screams died as Black Legion death squads homed in on their positions and murdered them in the inner sanctums. Cadia's evacuation plans had first been drawn up in the aftermath of the Second Black Crusade. As the order worked its way through the surviving servitor networks, embedded protocols took over the programmed functions of cyber-organic creatures. Cogitators that had been devoted to maintenance systems or planetary defense networks switched their focus to calling in landers from orbit, assessing unit strengths on the ground, and directing loyal forces to the best evacuation point. Mind-slaved servitors stopped working and stood in slack-jawed silence, trying to mouth the word, evacuate. But much had changed in the generations since the plans had been set down. The caution of Cadia's forebears was viewed with mistrust and suspicion, as if even the contemplation of evacuation was treachery. Over the generations, the evacuation protocols had been updated occasionally and haphazardly. The effects were sporadic and ill-conceived. Confusion reigned across Cadia, made only worse by the terrible ruin that had been made of the northern hemisphere of the planet. Units of the elite Cadian Fourth, who had been fighting guerrilla campaigns in the polar snows of Cadia Secundus, found their nearest evacuation station was on the far side of an Iron Warrior's plunder camp. With no choice, they launched a full frontal assault on the trench defences and found them abandoned, except for a handful of enslaved feral warriors. The 103rd Mechanized endured the tempest and earthquakes from within their Chimera armoured personnel carriers. Once the evacuation order came, they were confident of making it to their extraction point, which was only 20 miles away. But the land between had been so broken and reformed that it was impassable to tanks, and they were forced to abandon their vehicles and foot-slog it through the crazed patterns of lava fields, only to find, when they reached the evacuation point, that it had been swallowed in vast pools of bubbling red magma. The 46th Rifles were over 100 miles from their evacuation point. They forced marched through the night, abandoning any who were unable to keep moving, only to find that their evacuation point no longer existed, but had been flooded by the collapse of the Yukolov Dam. Other regiments found their extraction points located within massive war zones, or firmly held by units of the enemy, or that they were victims of a cruel glitch within the system, and they had been given erroneous details. Some found their evacuation sites in good order, with a clear command structure, ordered queues waiting for their landers to arrive. The truth dawned on them, as the hours and days wound on, that no one was coming to take them to safety. For them, the long war was over. Any attempts to resolve the confusion through the planet's Vox networks fell largely on increasingly hysterical ears, as commanders, who had kept their men alive over the last 3 months, finally gave vent to their fury and frustration and impotence, voxing it out into the ether for anyone who might hear. But the ears of the galaxy were closed. Even those who arrived at the extraction points understood that they were far from safe, as the warp reached out to embrace Cadia. The walls of the Immaterium had begun to shred, the laws of physics and order and reality no longer held, and the world began to fill with shapes and sounds and colours that defied human categorization. And the dark gods laughed. Chapter 10, Cadia Secundus. Point 29.443 had once been a part of a ridge of round-topped hills with rocky crags falling down towards the plain, but administratum landscapers had long since flattened the hills and spread the displaced earth out to create a wide, level place for planetary landers to pick up troops. Now, it had been designated as Evacuation Point 57B. It lay in the middle highlands of Cadia Secundus, a broad, level area 2 miles square, sealed with thick slabs of rockcrete. Before the War for Cadia, the edges of the slabs had been marked out by tufts of grass and old grox droppings. It had long mystified local grox herders, or bands of frozen white shields, stumbling lost through night exercises in the Mulep Hills and finding their feet on level ground. But now it offered the only hope of salvation to all the loyalists within 50 miles. First to arrive was Sister Heloise, mistress of repentance of the Sisters of Our Martyred Lady. She had 7 surviving Sisters Repentia with her. They had been scouring their sins away in battle with a warband of Black Legionnaires, but the Adeptus Astartes had disengaged an hour before the impact and left the Sisters hurling curses in their wake. They had struggled through the gales, hacking at packs of mewling demons, and now they had to secure this place. "Minister to the wounded," Heloise ordered her Sisters Repentia. Repentia Beatrice refused to move. One eye was covered by a black patch. The stubble of her scalp was sore and flaking. There were splatters of gore up her arms and thighs, and her eviscerator was resting on her shoulder. She looked out from the high plateau, saw the war and flames in the distance, and stuck out her chin. She had to shout over the roar of the gale. "We're warriors, not wet nurses. There is war out there." Heloise's pain lash caught Beatrice across the shoulder, and her knees gave way.
Why are you being punished?
Heloise demanded. Beatrice's pale cheeks flushed.
For disobedience, mistress.
Heloise's face thrust forward.
Exactly. The war here is almost done. It is our duty to serve, Repentia. And we are needed here. When the Cadian warriors have been taken safely off the planet, then we can remain and continue the fight.
Heloise pulled the mask from her head, and her black bob fell free, sweat-soaked and streaked with grey. Her face was drawn.
But I am the one who decides that. Understand?
She cracked her whip and caught Beatrice a second time. Repentia Beatrice ground the words out.
Yes, she said reluctantly. I will minister.
She used her eviscerator to push herself up again and slung the great weapon across her back. Beatrice was a warrior. Ministrations were not natural to her. The first band of survivors was staggering up the hill. It was a band of about 30 Cadians, some bootless and limping, others bandaged, striding through the storms. Their paces were pale and drawn. Beatrice clenched her hands into fists as she stared at them. In her heart, she saw them as failures. They were all failures. But she remembered her orders.
Welcome, brothers,
she called as they came forward. But her words were clumsy and unpracticed. She was better at singing war hymns, not offering consolation.
You have reached evacuation point 57B.
The men stared, eyes numb, minds pushed beyond their limits. Beatrice stepped forward and offered a hand to them, but her manner was stiff as a block of wood. The men shuffled forward, taking up their position, but at the back, two men lingered, one with his arm draped over the other.
Move along,
she told them, and pointed which way they should go. But as she did so, the man being helped along by the other staggered and fell. Beatrice stood over him.
Get up,
she commanded. But the man groaned and half rolled to the side. If she'd had a pain lash with her, she would have used it on the guardsman. But she looked up and saw the harsh gaze of her mistress Repentia on her. She moved forward and put a hand under the man's armpit.
Up,
she told him, but he did not move.
What is wrong with you?
She knelt next to him, her black knee greaves grating on the rock-reed surface, and prodded the body with her gauntlet.
He's dead, she said.
She stood and faced the man who had carried his friend. His eyes were rimmed with dirt. His lips were chapped. It looked like he had not slept for days. She saw a refusal to believe, and from somewhere, from deep within her, and from long ago, she felt a brief spark of pity.
What is your name, guardsman?
Nazar, he said. There was almost a touch of gentleness as she put a hand to his arm.
Nazar, you have reached safety. Have faith in the Emperor.
As the hours wore on, surviving units trickled in and were assigned one rockreed block to each regiment. It helped to organise the scattered units. Some of the rockreed squares were half full of surviving troops, others had only a handful. All the time the skies grew darker and darker. The howl of demons rang out. Men's fingers began to tremble. The hearts of veteran guardsmen began to beat faster. Repentia Beatrice pulled her eviscerator from her shoulder. Mistress Heloise cracked her whip and brought all the guardsmen together. She started to sing a hymn named Be Thou My Armour. The sisters Repentia sang with her, their voices high and beautiful.
Sing!
She ordered the guardsmen. One of them wasn't singing. She slapped him across the back of the head.
Sing!
She shouted. And as she patrolled up and down, the discordant voices of the guardsmen joined in. Evacuation point 88A, near Bastion 8. In the foothills behind Bastion 8, Lord Commissar Grake took command of evacuation point 88A. He arrived with the remains of the Cadian 77th Airborne, who had covered over 8 miles from where they had been managing a fighting retreat. His men were fearless in their dedication, and so far he had only shot 3 men in the entire 100-day campaign. As demon light began to flicker in the skies above them, he knew that only the most severe discipline would keep them alive. When the next company of men arrived, nearly 100 Cadians, they looked dead on their feet.
Halt!
Greg shouted. His black leather jacket flapped in the cold breeze as he paced towards them.
Attention!
He ordered, and despite their exhaustion, the men straightened up as they realized that they were being inspected. They straightened their tridome helmets, holstered their las rifles. Some even rubbed their boots on the back of their calves as Greg stalked along the line. He stopped before a man with a bandage on his head.
You,
the Commissar said. What is your name? The small man stepped to attention. He had a thin mustache and a weak stubble on his cheeks.
Guardsman Pip, the man said and saluted. Where is your rifle?
Greg demanded.
Pip looked about him.
I dropped it, sir.
Commissar Greg pulled out his pistol. One of the men in the second rank stepped forward to speak for him. From his uniform, he was the major.
Sir, he said, the last rifle was broken. We had wounded men to carry. I commanded him to drop his weapon.
Commissar Greg turned on him and shot the major in the head. He went down like a grox, the bolt round throwing him backwards and against the men behind him, who were splattered with bits of skull and brain and gore. Greg swung round to where Guardsman Pip stood and fired again. Pip fell against the men behind him. Commissar Greg holstered his pistol.
Now, who is in charge of this shambles?
The guardsman looked about for the highest surviving ranking officer. Two men exchanged glances, trying to work out which was the senior officer. Eventually, the older of the two stepped forward, his augmetic leg wheezing.
Major Luca,
the old man said, and saluted.
Retired twice, now serving as commanding officer of the 56th Rifles.
Commissar Greg looked at the old man.
This unit is a shambles. Bring them into proper order. Understand?
Major Luca saluted.
Yes,
he said, with an insolent pause.
Sir.
The black figure of Commissar Greg strode out to meet each squad of arriving guardsmen, bolt pistol holstered at his side, one hand to his peaked hat, his black leather coat flapping wildly in the wind. Within the space of half an hour, he had shot over 30 men. The mood of the 56th Rifles was already aggrieved, but with each retort of the bolt pistol, their resentment turned to hatred.
Someone should shoot him,
one muttered. Major Luca caught the man's eyes and gave him a warning look.
Hush,
he said. Accidents could happen, but it was better not to talk about them first. Homing beacons marked out the landing zone, but the skies were ominously dark. The troops huddled close as the gales whipped dust and soot into their eyes. The sky was growing constantly darker. Sudden gusts of rain lashed their faces, then changed to bouncing, stinging black balls of hail. Their home was a graveyard. Now it was turning into hell. They willed a lander to appear, to lift them safely off planet, and when the flashing lights of a transport finally did appear in the air above them, they stood as one, arms raised, as the white bar of a searchlight stabbed down towards them. The whipping clouds gave brief glimpses of the lander's pale belly, its cruciform shape, sponson weapons panning for enemy contacts. The landing gear was down. One of the ramps was already half open, and the men could see figures silhouetted against the inner light. The Cadian refugees stood and rushed forward. Some of the younger troops waved.
Back!
Commissar Greg ordered them.
Back!
The lander settled 50 yards from Major Luca. It was a standard ground-to-void shuttle, a broad, squat body with two pairs of short, back-flung wings. The dark upper surface was scarred with the bare blisters of autocannon rounds, but the craft looked sound. Smaller landing ramps lowered from both sides. The rear ramp came down in a series of three irregular jerks. An Navy rating ran forward, head low against the thrust of the lander's jets, the gales buffeting him sideways.
Who is in command here?
He shouted, one hand on his hat.
I am,
Greg said. The Lord Commissar stepped forward, his black leather coat flapping in the wind. The rating turned to him.
We only have 15 minutes, sir. Enemy fighters inbound.
Cue, Greg ordered them, waving his pistol. He stood on the landing ramps as the troops filed in. In regimental order. Leave equipment behind. Hurry! 10 minutes until we leave.
Half of Major Luca's 56th Rifles made it onto the lander, just as Greg signalled to the Navy rating. The ramp began to rise.
You cannot leave them,
Luca shouted, but Greg turned on him.
You dare to tell me my business, Major? Sir, I just want to say that these men should not be left behind. There is space on the lander. Let them on.
Luca stared back at the faces of the men they were leaving behind. It seemed that Greg was about to relent, but then a daring guardsman caught the lip of the ramp and started to haul himself up. Greg put a ball through his forehead. He shot two more who tried to clamber aboard. Major Luca turned away. He felt sick. They should have killed this commissar. The ramp closed with three jerks, slowing for the last few feet as the door seals engaged. Major Luca stared out as the view of his home narrowed to a handspan and then bare inches. The last image he saw of Cadia was through the Whipping Gales. Thousands of pale faces looking up, their expressions vivid in the white flash of the searchlight. Then the ramps closed with a hollow clang, a hiss of air, and the clunk of void seals engaging, and the noises of the storm were stilled. The lander was three quarters empty.
We should have taken more, Major Luca said.
Commissar Greg had holstered his pistol.
We should all have done more, he said,
and then turned on his heel and strode up the vast landing ramp, his footsteps ringing out in the hollow metal shell. Mirak River. General Bendix's evacuation point was at a levelled plateau named Old Man's Hill. His tanks were parked in neat lines, dust hissing through the gaps, the tank crews peering skywards. The lander touched down 100 yards away. Navy ratings waved the tanks forward. The troops quickly filed aboard. 20 minutes in, the engine started. Bendix was standing at the side of the main loading ramp.
What's happening?
Bendix demanded as the ramp started to close. No one listened to him.
Hey!
He shouted. The Navy rating managing the controls was a small, underfed-looking man with a baggy uniform two sizes too big for him.
We have to leave, he shouted.
He waved towards the cockpit as explanation. General Bendix looked back at the queues of men.
That's impossible, he shouted. Look!
There had to be 30,000 men waiting to load. The rating shrugged. It was all beyond him. He was just following orders.
Give me 5 minutes, he told the rating. Orders, the other man said. Damn orders, Bendix thought.
He pulled Tyson close enough to hear.
Do not let this man close the ramps until I say so, understand?
Tyson pulled his las pistol from its holster and flipped off the safety.
Understood, he said.
The rating's gaze went from one to the other and then to the las pistol. He looked sick.
You'll have to talk to the captain, he said.
I shall, Bendix said, and gathered 20 men. Bendix led his men to the front of the lander. The cockpit door was unlocked. He stepped inside. The snub-nosed chamber was cramped. The control panels were lit with buttons, levers, and green info screens. Bendix stooped. The pilots were strapped into their seats. To the right, by the door, three mind-slaved servitors were already starting the departure protocols.
This lander is not leaving, he announced.
The pilot did not turn around.
Sorry, we have to, or we won't get off the planet at all.
Bendix put his hand on the pilot's shoulder.
I said this lander is not leaving. I have an army here. You will stay until all of them are loaded. Is that clear?
The pilot turned. He was not used to being spoken to like this.
I have my orders, he said.
Bendix did not flinch. You have your orders, but I have a las pistol.
And if you do not do what I command, then none of us will leave this planet alive.
Lena and Ipsic managed to board the third lander that arrived at their evacuation point, along the banks of the Mirak River. They had driven their tank aboard, and now they crouched by the tracks of Hammer of Tyrok, nauseous with the buffeting turbulence of the higher atmosphere. The craft lurched again, and there was a cry of fear through the cramped deck. Even the tanks slid dangerously, and the chains that held them down creaked.
I hate landers, Lena said, as she wiped the vomit onto her sleeve. Put me back on Cadia.
There were tens of thousands of warriors like them, penned up inside the vast hangars of the landers, without any idea of what was happening.
We'll never make it,
Lena said, as the lander rattled dangerously. Ipsic kept his head down, his eyes closed. The last sight of Cadia had made him sick. All he could see was that vast column of smoke and ash, volcanic fires fountaining into the sky, and all he could taste was the dirt of Cadia in his mouth. Across Cadia, scenes of panic and order were taking place as fleets of landers descended from orbit straight to the prescribed extraction points. At some places, troops rushed the landing site, and the landers refused to set down. At others, fighting broke out, and half-empty transports lifted free, only to be brought down by a tank shell or melter charge. In places, it was Marauder bombers who landed, gunner crews pulling desperate guardsmen aboard. Some pilots stayed well beyond their allotted time. Others touched down at entirely deserted extraction points, the Navy ratings squinting out into the soot and ash storms and seeing no one to extract. Where the fighting had been fiercest, running battles took place with cultists who tried to scramble aboard. The lander crews took as many soldiers as time, orders, or opportunity would allow and lifted off, struggling to rise with the weight of the men and the women aboard. Once the carriers had lifted off, they had to face the hunter packs of chaos fighters and killers. Some had flights of thunderbolts and marauders that drove the enemy off, while some were undefended, and the enemy fell on them like hyenas on stray wildebeests, dragging the landers to the ground. Some of the evacuation craft reached high orbit, where fleet-based fighters and assault boats were still engaged in a furious battle for the skies of Cadia, and where they had to avoid the deadly impact of Black Legion assault torpedoes and dreadclaws. When they were boarded, some Cadians mounted furious defences, cutting down the Black Legion space marines with incandescent las rifle salvos. Others had been ordered to leave their weapons behind. They fought with whatever